This podcast is from the IDPF Digital Book 2012 Conference at Book Expo America.
So we have two presenters up presenting on disruptive business models. Just in terms of flow, they'll both present, and then we'll save a little bit of time at the end for questions that we can direct at either one of them. And if you would be so kind, if you have a question, to walk up to the microphone and line up so we get an idea of how many questions there are in the audience. So first up is Saul Rosenberg. He's Vice President of Business Development and Content Acquisition for Copia. And following Saul will be Eric Hellman, President of Glujar.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Dominic is always a very, very hard act to follow. And I will give you a little bit of coming attractions. My presenter after me, I have had a sneak preview, was pretty amazing as well. So you're in for an exciting afternoon, morning, I should say, and almost afternoon. And then you'll have to sandwich us in between. As I was preparing for this, talking about disruptive business models, just last week, there was this phenomenal presentation that Mary Meeker did. And if you haven't seen it yet, I invite you all to Google it and take a look at it. Basically, she reimagines everything and gives a tremendous amount of data. I'm not going to go through her 100-plus slide presentation, but you can download it, a wealth of great information. But it really got me thinking because it gave us a whole bunch of very, very interesting insight that directly affects our subject for today on disruptive business models. If you take a look at the ramp of what's been happening between the iPhone, pod, and then pad, and then Android, and how that's ramping. And then take a look at where we are with smartphone adoptions today versus where they're going to be and what the upside is like. So look, you see this great area is the yet-to-be-conquered part of people's behavior and where our new business is all coming from. So it's not so much about what can I do to make this book great in the current market. It's how am I growing the business in new ways that people haven't used before. And if you just look around you at this conference and other conferences, you'll see it right away. You look at how many people are using tablets of all kinds and readers that have never done before in just a few years. So the rate of change increases dramatically. And the upside is there on this whole new market as people are using smartphones and other mobile devices for content consumption. And then Mary Meeker goes on to reimagine so many things. For example, computing devices, obvious, right? Then reimagining things like navigation and live traffic. Those of us who remember getting our AA triptych and trying to figure things out and listening to traffic reports versus using things like Waze and other things today. And she has this whole long list of like 40 or 50 different things in our lives that have been reimagined with technology today. And this is just the beginning. And everyone out there is being creative about thinking, what can we do to totally change our lives and coming up with new tools. Now, this has a direct effect on our business. So let's just park that thought for a moment, and we'll get back to it in a moment. No doubt, like me, you've all heard about the years of reports about the closing and the dwindling of the independent bookstores and chains. And been written about by all sorts of pundits and all sorts of articles, and we've seen it happen. Okay? Yet, as I will, my position is that I believe the bookstore has a tremendous new life ahead of it as it reimagines itself, as we'll get to in just a moment. A little bit about Copia, for those of you who don't know us. We're basically both a bookstore and a social network, uniting content and community with all kinds of different genres and connecting groups, discussions, annotations, allowing you to annotate within the margins of the book as well. And what's different about us in the way we go about gaining audience is unlike the Apple, Amazons, and Google of the world that are out to push their brand and get their customers to come to them, we work with partners. So we're out not looking to push our brand, but working with partners. For example, we are currently powering over 900 different, 48, I believe, different universities, each one with its own brand. So if you go to Kansas or Stanford or Cornell or Colorado, and while you're on campus, as part of the campus bookstore, you get the whole COPE experience, but it's branded as that particular campus. It's part of the campus experience, what's happening on campus, school newspapers, all those kinds of things. Go to Brazil, one of the largest retailers of physical books, and one of the largest, actually, e-tailers generally is a company called Submarino. And for their digital side, we partnered with them. And again, we're just sort of in the background, but giving them this entire new experience of uniting content and community and being able to annotate within the margins of the books and all the other wonderful features, which I won't harp on today. In Australia, we've partnered with all the independent bookstores there. Something very unique in Australia is it makes up about more than 20% of the marketplace. And likewise, they're looking for a very special solution that will help catapult them into what is the next phase, and that's really what we're all about. So we'll park that. That's point two. Now, one of our other reimaginings, and this is sort of the point that brought it all home, and, you know, may not like Glenn Beck, but he does sell books. And she brought him up as an example of reimagining the distribution and monetization of talent that rather than staying on a network, okay, he went off and did his own internet thing where he'll make a ton more money. And he's started to prove that. And we actually are powering a boutique shop for him. And it was just amazing because there were books that I had never heard of before that, like a hockey stick, just out of nowhere. Because he sells a lot of books, and he has a voice, and he has a following. And there we're going to get to what you find to be a very weird question, but what does he have in common with indie booksellers? And the answer, and this clip won't play well, but there's this great, for those of who are into Les Mis and have seen the 25th anniversary, it's this great scene where they got all these great tenors on stage, and then this new young guy named Alfie Bo comes out, and he just blows them all away. So it's really about finding your voice and curating your voice and finding your audience. And if you remember that graph we saw before and the upside, that is the difference. And today, with today's tools, really, anybody can be selling digital content. They just need the right platform to do it. So people who didn't do it before can be in that business. So the same thing it took for a Glenn Beck to go out and find ways to monetize himself by using his influence and using his voice is what's made in the bookseller special over the years. You go someplace, you like the people behind there, they have a certain take on things, you ask them for recommendations, they do things a certain way. Now what they need is some help and some tools to go out there and be able to expand beyond just maybe their neighborhood and really put a little, like a megaphone behind their voice. So taking their voice and being able to project it out is what's going, in my opinion, is going to take the indie bookstores, give them the opportunity, along with anybody else who wants to sell digital content that has an audience, to take advantage of that ramp that we are yet to see in the evolution of digital content and the huge upside. So, as a summary, it's really about reimagining yourself, about finding the right partners, and developing and using your voice. Thank you very much.
Hi, everybody. Can you hear me? I'm Eric Hellman. I'm president of Glue Jar, Inc. And just 2.5 weeks ago, we launched a new site called Unglue It. So I'm going to give you a report about the first 2.5 weeks and what the whole thing is about. And I'm glad that Saul talked about reimagining things, because I'm going to ask you to imagine a lot of things in my talk. I'm going to ask you to imagine that everything Saul told you was wrong, never happened. I'm going to ask you to imagine that books never existed. And it's only by that way that we can start to think about how ebooks could evolve in a future that doesn't have all the past baggage that we have with a paper copy, pretend it's print business model. Okay. So once upon a time, this is a fairy tale, all right? So just imagine. Imagine that books hadn't been invented. Imagine that Jeff Bezos in the future invents a time machine and goes back and kills Gutenberg. So books don't exist. But storytellers are part of the human condition, and storytellers exist. So storytellers make money in this world of no books by going around to towns and telling stories. And they gather lots of people together in the town square and tell them a story. And then they pass a hat. And they say, if you guys want to hear another story, I want you guys to fill up my hat with money. And that's what people did. And the storytellers were happy. They went around and made money getting cash from people. And the story listeners were happy because they got lots of storytellers coming to tell them stories. But an inventor came along, and his name was Kindle Radio. And he invented this device that he named after himself and called it the radio. And he had a brilliant plan. He started making recordings of storytellers. He got some of the best storytellers, or this was his plan. He was going to get all these recordings, and then he would put those stories on his radio. And every radio was fitted with a coin slot. And so what his idea was is that if you just put a quarter into the slot of your Kindle radio, and it would tell you a story. Anyway, he thought it was just this incredible plan. But storytellers thought he was crazy because, I mean, people fill our hats with money when we tell them stories so that they like. And why do they need these stupid little devices to do it for us? The story listeners thought this guy was crazy too because, you know, you want us to put a quarter in before we've heard the story? What if the story is really boring? And besides, if the story's bad, we like being able to heckle the storyteller. His employees thought he was crazy too, because the plan was to have all these guys go around to people's houses and empty the coins out of the slots and take careful notes as to what each of the people had, which stories they had read, so that they could, you know, provide the royalties to the storytellers. But the employees knew this was crazy because somebody else the year before had invented shotguns, and they knew they wouldn't get a lot of coins out of the radios. But Kindle's wife, her name was Public, she was having none of it. Forget the coin slot, she told Kindle. Sell the radios. Make the signal free. And people will figure out smarter ways to put quarters in the storyteller's hats. And Kindle, wanting to stay married, he obeyed his wife, as she has promised. And the radios, he adopted her business model, which was, of course, the public radio business model. The radios became bestsellers, and more people filled storyteller hats than ever before because people could listen to the stories all over the place, and the storytellers could reach more and more people to fill their hats with cash. So this is a business model that digital books enable that you can't really do with print books. And so one thing that I have started to look into is how can we make the public radio model work for books? So let's think about it from a business standpoint. The structure of public radio is actually quite similar to the structure of a potential ebook publishing industry. You still have a big fixed cost to make a book, But if you find a way where you can cover that fixed cost, it's possible to serve additional listeners at essentially zero marginal cost. In radio, it works because you get people to donate to their radio station, and then they listen for free. And then you have pledge drives, but all that. You get mugs and tote bags and whatever. In the digital market, we have in the U.S. these institutions called libraries, which we spend about $10 billion on. And they're not going away, no matter how much Amazon wants to kill them off or how much publishers don't want to let them lend e-books. They're going to be around. And their mission is to distribute content. So the publisher of an e-book does not have to spend any money to distribute a book as long as they're willing to set aside DRM and things like that if they find a way to monetize that content. So what we are doing is we are providing a mechanism for readers to choose books to support, allow rights holders to run a pledge drive for every book that they want to offer to the public. And we're using crowdfunding to do this. Now, the trailblazers in the crowdfunding business are sites like Kickstarter, which is now frequently having up to over super million-dollar campaigns on various thingamajigs that artists and people are coming up with and offering to get funded. A more traditional group that does the same thing is the Nature Conservancy. They get people to give them money. They acquire property and preserve it for the good of the country. So let me tell you how Unglue It works. This is a book. It was published in 1970 by Oxford University Press. It's called Oral Literature in Africa by Ruth Finnegan. Now, this book created a whole field of academic study and by compiling lots of examples of oral literature in Africa. But over the years, it's gone out of print. The rights have reverted to the author, and it's not available either. You can get it used, but you can't get it as an e-book, for example. And worst of all, it's not available in Africa. So African scholars who want to study oral literature in Africa can't get a hold of this seminal work in their field. So we're working with the new publisher of this book to run a campaign to make it free to the world. So we provide a website. They've made a new cover since they don't have rights to the old one. And we describe the book, and we offer anyone on the internet the opportunity to support this book and make it free. At certain pledge levels, they can get perks like have their names put in the front matter of the book, or get a print copy of the book, or other kinds of ways to commemorate their support. It's been our most successful title so far. We have about 140 people who have contributed to the project in the first 2.5 weeks. The goal is $7,500, and we're at about 40% right now. Just clicking the support button lets you pledge to make the book free. And we don't collect any money from the donors until we have enough support to make the whole $7,500 available to the rights holder. So what we're doing is we are creating a community of support around this book. Now, that's one book. What happens when we reach the goal of the campaign? Well, what we do is we make sure that the rights holder produces a Creative Commons licensed edition of the book. Well, we put that Creative Commons edition in Internet Archive, other libraries that are online, and it can be distributed by anyone. Right. So what have we learned so far? We launched 2.5 weeks ago. We've had almost 20,000 visitors. We've signed up over 1,000 people who want to help us unglue ebooks. And this is the beginning of a movement to take our cultural heritage and make it available to our children and our grandchildren, whether they have money to buy it or not. So what else have we learned so far? Well, the three things I'll talk about, one is Remix, one is Russians, and one is archivists. So Remix. It turns out that at least in this early stage of our project, the people who are most motivated to donate to this movement are people like who are doing open source or care about free culture. And so what we've seen is people are really interested in exactly which Creative Commons license we're using. And we had assumed that most authors would want to use the most restrictive Creative Commons license, which is allows for no derivative works and non-commercial use only. But in fact, our most successful title, Oral Literature in Africa, was being offered with the most least restrictive Creative Commons license. And if you think about it, it's only appropriate because a work compiling oral literature in Africa is taking from the culture of a continent. But now we have, through the Creative Commons licenses, we have a way to create an ebook that allows people to make derivatives, like add in their own stories, take out stories if they want to, and distribute it as widely as possible, make translations of it into the different African languages. So that's what we learned, or one thing we learned. But we don't know that that will translate into, you know, 10,000 users or 100,000 users, but that's what our first 1,000 users care about. So second, Russians. We looked at our traffic, and on one day, half of it came from Russia. And we looked into it, and it had gone viral on the Russian equivalent of Slashdot, and then on the Russian equivalent of Facebook, and which is called VK. And VK, part of its popularity derives from the fact that it's closely integrated with BitTorrent. So we're wondering why the Russians are into this. Maybe it's just the free ebooks. But, you know, they have this amazing cultural tradition of producing great writing and great literature. And they have this tradition of having books that are very inexpensive. And they have this tradition of trusting things, that books that they get from their friends and neighbors, more than the books they get from the official government apparatus. So maybe having a way to distribute books that's free of monitoring by Amazon and Apple appeals to them. But anyway, we're looking to see what exactly is going on and how we can serve that market. So the third thing that happened that we were really pleased to see was the beginning of little groups. If you look at this list of books, you might notice that there's one that seems out of place. Hunger Games, Lord of the Rings, Freakonomics, describing archives? Well, what happened was a bunch of archivists said, you know this book that our Society of American Archivists published that all of us need to use, and it has a set of standards for how to describe archives. This is something that everybody in our profession should have, and not only that, people outside of our profession need access to it. And it's ridiculous for us not to give it away for free as an ebook. Why don't we use Unglue It to raise funds to cover all the fixed costs of producing the book. And so in the space of an hour, we got about 30 archivists join the site and pledge for this book. And so this was a hope of ours that each book that's published can find an audience this way, an audience willing to support it, an audience that maybe loves the book and wants a way to express their love in a way that advances the author or the publisher, the producer of the book. And so it was really nice to see it actually happen. So in conclusion, we need a lot of help to make this work. This is a big change, and it's a very steep hill. But we started out with just a campaigns for five books. And that's like a tiny drop in what we hope will be an ocean. But we have to start somewhere. The books we started with are not particularly prominent. The 1970 book is kind of obscure, but it's important to some people. So we need a lot of help to make this work, and if you'd like to support it, we'd love to have you as an ungluer. The broader thing I'd like to emphasize is that once you break the shackles of this business model that's tied to a physical artifact and insist that people try to pay per copy of a thing that doesn't cost anything to make a copy of, there are new possibilities. It's not going to work for everything, but there are markets, there are applications where the attribute of being free is really important to people and can drive new applications. And as long as we can find a way to cover the cost of producing the book, find a way to pay the authors what they really deserve, we can make free ebooks work. So this is the end. This is my contact. I write the Go to Hellman blog. Please come and help us unglue it.
Well, thank you very much. So we have about 10 minutes for questions. Anybody who has a question, just please line up behind the microphone and direct it to one or the other or both, and they'll fight for which one who goes first.
So I understand the disruptive nature of Eric's business model. So I wasn't clear on what the disruptive dimension of your business model was, and I'd be interested in knowing your lessons for us.
Sure. Thank you. Idea here is who can go out and get into the compete with Amazon business. And what does it take to do that? So I think you can, the bottom line is that anybody, if they find the right partner, can do that. The differential is the voice, okay? And not to discount what makes every indie unique and what makes anybody who builds an audience unique, which is being able to use their voice and being able to build a group around the things that are most important to them. This includes authors, includes media companies, includes charities, includes other membership organizations that do various kinds of good things around the world. They all can be in this business, and many of them are choosing to.
So just to clarify, so the business model of the selling books is very similar to Amazon, but it's a question of who can enter into that market.
Correct, and take advantage of what Marriott pointed out in terms of the real upside of a market. It's not like we're all grappling to see what we can eke out of this pie that exists, but rather there's this whole big pie that hasn't yet even begun to tap as people are shifting more and more into consuming on smartphones and other very, very mobile devices. Can I ask him a question? Okay. Sorry. Why did you say that your thing can only work for ebooks? Like, why couldn't unglue would work for a physical book, theoretically?
Well, for a physical book, you do have the cost of the distribution channel that you have to cover. So
the number's higher. But
Well, if you had to give away 5 million copies of any book, no matter how your how low the cost of your distribution chain, it's going to be significant.
Okay. Appreciate it.
The ungluit model is oriented towards rescuing forgotten books, as I've seen it presented. What about its, or I'm sorry, I should rephrase that as maybe those are in your examples, but books which have already been published and making them available under a Creative Commons license. What about books which are yet to be published, if the prospective publisher can raise or author can raise X amount, then it could be released under some Creative Commons license.
Well, so the big problem for prospective authors is finding a support base. How is a new author going to find a new support base? If it's just an idea, well, Kickstarter works for that.
But for established authors, where you have some idea of...
For established authors, the main thing about running campaigns for books is figuring out how to gather a community around the book. And established authors have the possibility to do that. So I think that will probably happen.
And if I may offer just a follow-up answer that ties into your previous answer as well. In that upside, we also have to remember that the forms of what we call an ebook today, it'll change radically. I mean, look at all the work that Dominique has been doing at Sourcebooks, different kinds of sites, different kinds of business models. All that has yet to be uncovered, and different kinds of content will have different kinds of business models. And it'll keep going. And the idea was, I think this, what Mary Meeker's talk about reimagining everything really sparked in my mind is, yeah, we have to really totally really imagine how every little bit of what we do changes and how it could change based upon new tools and new market opportunities.
Hey, Saul, how's the note sharing capability work in Copia? I mean, how are you guys, is it within a class? Is it across the platform? How does it work exactly?
Thank you for asking. Actually, it depends on the reader's choice. Which is, you can decide to just keep your notes private and have no one see it. You can, the person who writes the notes can decide if they want to share it with just a select group of people that they've made or just their friends, or make it available to the world at large. Likewise, on the receiving end, you can decide whether you want to see everybody's notes, just your friends' notes, just certain groups' notes. So on both sides of the equation, there's plenty of choices and settings and preferences as to what somebody wants to see, or just decide they don't want to see anything and just even move away the whole sidebar and it doesn't even appear.
And can the instructors make that choice too, or is it?
The question is, can the instructors make the choice? And yes, what we have is also the notion of a private group. So in many universities, you have groups just for specific courses where the professor has a special page and things for their particular course, and it's just the students in the class, and they're communicating on that basis. It's very silent. Okay, well, thank you all very much. We appreciate your time and attention. Have a great day.